Support for WKAR is provided by MSU Federal Credit Union, providing credit union members with 24-hour account access online and now on your mobile internet, insured by NCUA, and by MSU.
Welcome to Current State for Thursday, 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. A fun and interesting show here today. We've got live music all hour. That music is coming to you live from Bob Baldori. And Bob's got a new movie out called Boogie Stomped. You've probably heard about it. And Bob's going to be providing the musical soundtrack here for us all this hour. And we're going to talk with him in just a little while about being in the movie business, which is something new for him. Bob Baldori coming up. Also, have you heard of the human microbiome? This is essentially a fancy word for the pounds of bacteria that each one of us schleps around in our body, which is kind of gross. But the truth of the matter is, we're learning that a lot of this bacteria can be put to really good use. We've got a very interesting segment on that, and we visit with the radio reader, Dick Estelle, coming up here on Current State. But first, to start the show, in a plan adopted last year by its Board of Trustees, Michigan State University committed to an energy future comprised fully 100% of renewable energy resources. Or sources, I should say. This afternoon, University President Luana K. Simon updates the effort in her second annual Energy Roundtable, which will be a live webcast. And here to talk about President Simon's gathering and the larger issues involving campus energy and its economic impact is Jennifer Battle. Jennifer is Assistant Director for the Office of Campus Sustainability at MSU. Nice to see you this morning.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Tell us about all who are participating in President Simon's conversation and what they'll be talking about.
Yeah, we're actually excited. This is our second conversation, as you'd mentioned before, and we have a small panel of President Simon, Brandon Markin from Everlast Lighting, and then also Bruce Thompson from Rockford Construction. And the message really is not only about what Michigan State's committed to and as far as taking a leadership role in energy for our campus, but how that really impacts other businesses around the state and how they're able to take advantage of opportunities so that through investing in energy efficiency and renewable energy resources has provided a positive impact on their businesses.
So MSU essentially is kind of a laboratory for the transition to greener energy, and you just want to share that information here.
Well, absolutely, and I think it's also important for the businesses to say what the benefit has been to them. So certainly we want to walk the talk. So we've made a commitment to moving towards renewable energy, to reducing our greenhouse gas emissions, but also how we're working with these other organizations around the state for them to for the building the infrastructure for that green economy and how we're partnering with them to do so.
Now, will this include opportunities for students, staff, or even the public to raise points, ask questions?
Absolutely. We've got a small live audience, and people can also submit questions via Twitter by using the hashtag MSU Energy. So we're encouraging people throughout the event, which is at 11 o'clock this morning, to submit their questions, comments, etc., via Twitter, and whatever we can answer will be answered on our website, energytransition.msu.edu, early next week.
Energy, that's an interesting website, too, by the way, energytransition.msu.edu. There's a lot there, and it's all really interesting. The university claims to be one of the top sustainable campuses in the country on that website, yet in the energy transition plan, it states that renewable energy makes up less than 2% of the energy mix at MSU. Can you help us understand how both of those can be true?
Absolutely. Well, first of all, there are a lot of organizations that rank institutions in sustainability, and we've received numerous rankings from NWF was where we were ranked one of the top five sustainable campuses, and then also Princeton Review is annually ranked us among the top universities. So a lot of those are based on a number of factors: energy, waste reduction, water conservation, etc. However, having those rankings for us doesn't mean that we are in a perfect position. We feel that there's a lot more we can do in the energy area, particularly with renewable energy and energy efficiency, and that's why we set some aggressive goals for ourselves. So at the beginning of the plan, in our baseline year, we virtually didn't have any renewable energy on campus.
And what that baseline year was
2009-2010, that fiscal year. But since then, we've added, solar panels as recycling center. We're adding more biomass at the power plant. We've added a geothermal system at the life sciences building addition. And we're the board also last year approved the construction of an anaerobic digestion facility, which should be opening in fall of 2013 of this year.
One of these surveys you referred to, the STARS, it's called the STARS program for short, rates campuses across the country regarding their efforts to transitioning to green energy. MSU fared respectably in the latest STARS report in a number of categories, and there are a lot of them, but we apparently ranked less impressively in terms of divestment in fossil fuel companies. This is one of their criteria. Last week, as you know, a letter signed by some 20 faculty and staff supported the call for divestment in fossil fuel companies specifically. Is the administration going to seriously consider this?
Well, first, just a clarification. The STARS categories looks at our endowment practices and not necessarily where you've invested, but the practice of how you either inform the community, et cetera. And most institutions have practices that are very similar to ours. So most, if you look at the ASHE rankings, that most institutions scored about where we scored in that area.
You don't get a lower ranking for investing in fossil fuel
companies?
You get
less points.
And
it's
you get less points for
it's an endowment practice, not necessarily a number for investment. But either way, going back to your other question about the Sierra Clubs initiative, the Student Sierra Clubs initiatives was coupled with 350.org, the divestment fossil fuel campaign. Last week, the students and then who were also speaking on behalf of the faculty who signed the letter presented to the Board of Trustees and about divesting from fossil fuels. Certainly anything that's brought before the board is considered. But what I understand is through our energy transition plan, of course, we're already making a commitment to move away from fossil fuels and invest in renewable energy resources. So through our practice here on campus at Michigan State, we're moving away from using fossil fuels. We're looking at more ways to invest in renewable energy. And my understanding is currently our direct cash holdings that we have less than 0.5% invested in the companies that were identified in that list.
It's clearly fewer than a lot of other universities. I mean, I think it's pretty clear U of M is invested a great deal more in fossil fuel companies than Michigan State, but still there seems to be a growing call for this. This is really in the hands of the board, though, I would presume, the board and the administration.
Sure, the board and the administration, those who look at endowments. And so just like anything that's brought to the board and to the administration, all these things are seriously considered. We look at it, and so I anticipate there will be a similar process.
How long will the campus rely on coal? How will that decrease over time?
Well, it already has decreased. So our baseline year, which again was 2009-2010, we were using 85% coal. So our power plant is fuel flexible and can use both coal and natural gas, and at that time we're at 85%. Through fuel switching, we've moved that to 36% and are continuing to move away from coal through fuel switching and, again, adding other renewable energy resources to campus. So that trend, through our transition plan, that is a trend that needs to continue in order for us to meet our goals.
I think it gets a little confusing because green energy advocates are in the news fairly regularly complaining about the university's use of coal and other issues. They're very persistent. How would you suggest the wider public view this back and forth between MSU and the green energy community?
Well, you know, I guess I don't view it necessarily as an us versus them. I think that one of the wonderful things about being on a college campus is that there's debate, there's dialogue, there's disagreement, and through that, I think it makes us all better. When we put together the energy transition plan, we had a lot of these voices on the committee. We have a lot of different faculty and staff, et cetera. So I think that what's great is that students and faculty and those who don't agree also have the opportunity to to pose solutions. And in fact, this morning I had an opportunity to hear about a lot of the solutions posed from a lot of our students who had issues with the plan last year. And then through some of the projects that we've worked with them on, have recommended different technologies and programs in order for us to better meet our goals. So, for example, some of the student organizations, they formed a sustainable energy committee and have been working on daylight harvesting technologies with our staff. They've been working on energy incentive programs to reduce energy use and reduce fuel use. And so I think that that is really the beauty of having a lot of different voices at the table, so for us to take advantage of all of our different areas of expertise, all of our different opinions, and really create a better future for Michigan State in the energy side.
Jennifer Battle is the Assistant Director for the Office of Campus Sustainability here at Michigan State University. She's been talking about President Luana K. Simon's update this afternoon. Her second annual Energy Roundtable will be a live webcast. Nice to see you, Jennifer. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Bob Bell Dory there on the keys. The love theme from Current State here on 90.5 WKAR. We're going to be talking with Bob about his movie Boogie Stomp coming up in just a little bit. Dick Estelle, the radio reader, also coming up on the program today. It is estimated that each human body is host to about 3 to 5 pounds of bacteria. That is a lot of bacteria, and when we think of microscopic organisms, we often think harmful to our health, right? But over the last several years, there's been a thrust in scientific research concerning all of this bacteria that live on and inside our bodies. The early findings have been astounding and seem to point to a paradigm shift in medicine. The research has the potential to unveil new methods to treat all sorts of common diseases, including diabetes, asthma, even obesity. And here to help explain the enormous potential behind the research into what's called the human microbiome is MSU microbiologist Rob Britton. Nice to see you, Rob. How are you?
Oh, good. Thanks for having me.
Just briefly, what is the human microbiome? This is the bacteria that live on and inside our bodies?
Yes, and so the human microbiome really refers to the collection of genes that are within the communities that live within and upon our body. The term microbiota refers to the microbial communities themselves. And as you mentioned in the introduction to your segment, we think that most people will think that's gross. But in essence, that's because we always think that bacteria are bad and they actually cause disease. But essentially, 99.9% of the time when we're feeling good and we're healthy, and that the bacteria are actually there all the time, and they're promoting this health. And so that's really what the NIH Microbiome Project is trying to do, is to try to figure out how we're going to be able to promote health using microbiology, and what happens to those communities when we actually get sick. So why do we actually get sick when these communities get out of whack?
Was there a sort of an aha moment that helped push this research into the forefront, or have we known that there's beneficial bacteria for a long time?
Well, we've actually known that there's been beneficial bacteria for a long time. It's really been a rediscovery of this notion. So back in the early 1900s, the Nobel Prize-winning immunologist Ilya Metchnikoff actually decided, after he won the Nobel Prize, to spend the next part of his career trying to figure out why Bulgarian peasants live longer than everybody else in Eastern Europe. And what he found out was that it was because they drank kefir, or this fermented milk. And he even went so far as to suggest it was because of the lactic acid bacteria that was in that milk that was causing them to be healthy. And so interestingly, the reason that we've really rediscovered all this is really due to technology. And so one is that because we have 100 trillion microbes in our gut, how do you study something that diverse? I mean, it's really difficult to study all of these organisms at once. And so next-generation sequencing technologies, which allow us now to study 50 billion base pairs of DNA in a single experiment, are now allowing us to explore the basically the microbiome, or the essentially the 5 million genes that are now present in our body as part of the microbial genomes. And that's 1,000 times more than the genes that we have in our human genome. We only have 25,000 genes in our own genome. So they really provide a lot of physiological and important functions for our body.
One really fascinating feature of this whole story involves childbirth. And I've read that birth through the vaginal canal, as opposed to a cesarean section, is where crucial bacteria are actually picked up. Can you tell us more about the role of childbirth in the development of our microbiome?
Well, certainly. So before you're born, you're thought to be sterile. And so you become colonized initially through passage through the vaginal tract. And so if you're born through cesarean section, you actually miss that opportunity to be colonized with certain bacteria. And, of course, you're usually being fed formula or milk, and so that's another issue. There's thought to be milk oligosaccharides that are important for developing our microbiome. So if you're being fed formula, that can raise some problems. And then there's thought to be an ecological succession. So as babies continue to be fed formula and then move into solid foods, essentially your microbiome then changes over time until we get to essentially what's an adult state. But what I can tell you is that adults, you and I would, if we looked at our microbiome right now, they would look pretty much completely different. We wouldn't really know exactly that we have the same sort of functional microbiome. And that's one of the really interesting things that's come out of all these studies, is that it's not necessarily that we all share the same species that we could identify with a name, but it's usually probably the functions that they provide. And so that's why it's been very difficult to move from understanding how these communities get shifted to basically how they function when they're giving us good health, and what happens to them when they undergo a dysbiosis, or which is really referring to when these communities get out of whack. How do they cause problems such as allergies and diarrhea and obesity? And that's really what a lot of studies in my lab and really all over the world are going after now.
What's the timeline on this? Do you have any kind of feeling for when we might really strike gold with this, I suppose, just in terms of a treatment or a cure for a disease? Is that on anybody's radar?
Well, you know, interestingly, there already is a cure for disease using microbes, and that is actually a project that we also study in my lab, and that's studying Clostridium difficile, which is
C. diff.
Yeah, C. diff, right? It's a pathogen that actually is the most common cause of antibiotic-associated diarrhea, and it's really a problem now because it is also the most common cause of hospital-acquired infections. So you go to the hospital, you're sick, you don't want to be there anyway. And then on top of it, you get this nasty diarrhea. And unfortunately, for a number of patients, anywhere from 15 to 40%, depending on the outbreak, they will actually have recurring C. diff, which means they go through a terrible cycle of they go to the hospital, they get diarrhea, they get nasty antibiotics to get rid of C. diff, and then 2 weeks later after the antibiotics are stopped, they get it again. And you can have 25, 30, 35 bouts of this in a year. Essentially, you can't do anything. And so what the best therapy for that is, in fact, a fecal transplant.
A fecal transplant.
Yeah, so now we can say that's gross. Bacteria are gross, but that's gross. And essentially, what is done is that these people, what has probably happened to them is their microbial communities are just so disrupted that they can't recover after the antibiotic treatment. So we basically transplant another community from usually a family member, and that's 92% effective in breaking a recurrent C. diff. Now, the problem with that is that, of course, you're transferring a lot of other things in stool, so things like worms and viruses and fungi. And so we really want to try to build a community synthetically that we can isolate from the human microbiota and basically put that in rather than putting in stool.
Wow. There's been a glut of health products. I don't think anybody's visited the health food store lately that hasn't seen a product that touts probiotic cultures. Yogurt is associated with this to quite an extent, and in other foods. Do these help?
Well, I think in general, yes, they do help. But what I can say about the sort of the probiotic industry is essentially that many of these organisms that you can go out and buy right now on the market are ones that have not been scientifically or clinically validated. And so if you're a consumer and you go out to look at, say, Foods for Living, the health food store locally here, you could have 100 or so products that are thrust at you, many from very small companies. And so what I can say is that they probably will not hurt you, but there's probably not a lot of evidence for the small company ones that will actually help you. Because they're dietary supplements, they really have not passed the muster in terms of having clinical studies that you would need to do to have a drug. And that's why when you go out, the products will not say that we will cure diarrhea, we'll cure obesity, we'll cure this, because if they say that, the FDA is going to regulate them like a drug. And so it's a bit of a conundrum. And the NIH is well aware that the bacteria are going to have a role in our health in the future, and there's going to be therapeutic microbiology. And it will, in my opinion, in the next 10 to 15 years, we'll start seeing real products that are going to be targeted for these diseases. But it's going to take time because the FDA is going to say, if we're going to target microbiology or bacteria to help a disease, you're going to have to prove it to us the same way that a drug will be done.
How many students do you work with who are involved in this kind of research here at MSU?
Well, right now I've got about 15 people in my lab, and so we work in a number of different areas, one of which being C. diff, trying to basically build a synthetic community to help people with recurrent C. diff get out of that relapse without having to use stool.
Is that you spend a lot of your time on that particular?
That's one of our main projects in the lab right now.
Okay.
And we also are working on a really interesting project where we have found a probiotic bacterium that can actually improve bone health, both in a type 1 diabetes model and also in a mouse model of menopause. And so we're really excited about that. We're getting very close to submitting that for publication, and we're hoping to have a human trial start here in the next 6 to 12 months.
How did you end up in this study? Did you know a long time ago that you wanted to be involved in microbiology, or?
Well, to be honest, when I arrived here, I was very much a basic researcher, studying stuff most of your listeners would probably never have even heard of. But when I got here, I realized that I did want to do something applied, and it was pretty clear with funding the way it is these days that, NIH has said, look, we want translational research, and for good reason. People are, spending their tax dollars. They want to see some payoff from what they're doing. And so that's how we got into probiotics. Fortunately, we did early on when it wasn't so sexy to be working on probiotics or the microbiome. So we've had a pretty good run here in the last few years, and we have some good traction in this area. We hope to be making some big discoveries in the next 5 to 10 years.
Have you learned anything else about health in general that might be of value to just the ordinary person listening? Do you have any other insights that you might be in a position to share with us?
Well, what I would say is that based on your intro to the show, when you said the bacteria are gross, I just want people to know that, the fact of the matter is that bacteria are actually quite good for you. And in fact, we wouldn't be here. People are thinking of bacteria as the forgotten organ now, because it basically, if we didn't have them, our immune systems wouldn't develop. We couldn't eat food the way we do. And we wouldn't be here, quite frankly. So we really, so your listeners, please, bacteria, good. Be nice to them. They're nice to you, and they're important for you. Thanks.
Rob Britton is an associate professor of microbiology here at Michigan State University. Thanks for joining us today to talk about the fascinating research into the human microbiome.
Thanks, Martin.
From her happiness, her own little son named Johnny B. Goode was gonna make a motion picture out in Hollywood. Hollin' bye, 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 bye.
Boogie Bob Bell Dory live in the studio. He's coming up later on Current State. Stay where you are. Thank you. Boogie Bob Bell Dory here in the Current State studio this morning. Bob's not only a musician, he's in the movie business now, as it turns out. So we'll be talking with him about Boogie Stomp coming up in just a little bit here on Current State. But first, every day, thousands of listeners here in mid-Michigan hear a rich baritone voice. Dick Estelle is the longtime host of the Radio Reader on WKAR AM 870. His program can be heard not just in mid-Michigan, but on dozens of public radio stations across the country. And next year, Dick celebrates 50 years as the Radio Reader. But his radio roots go back even farther. He joined WKAR in 1955 as a student announcer. By 1964, he was station manager, and it's our pleasure to have him on our show today. Dick Estelle, welcome to Current State.
Thank you.
You joined the staff in 55. You'd served in the Air Force prior to that. How did you become interested?
Well, prior to that, really, I was in commercial radio for 5 years.
Okay.
But prior to that,
how did you get into broadcasting in the first place?
I went to Don Martin's School of Radio and TV Sciences in Hollywood, California. Back in those days, you had to have an engineer's license in order to be on the air. And so the Don Martin School was one of the areas in the United States that had classes which provided you with that license.
Did you grow up in California?
No.
Okay.
No, I'm a Michigan man from the day of birth until today.
Okay, but you spent a couple of critical years in Hollywood.
Yes.
Is that it? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
What was the sound of WKAR in 1955?
I remember hearing a number of 16-inch discs being played, provided to us by different sources. The sound really was more classical music, I think, than anything else.
Okay.
We had, as our manager, a man who had worked for RCA Victor for a number of years, and so he actually brought that background of classical music through RCA Victor to him, to here, to Michigan State. And so I think that probably more, there was news, of course, but more classical music than anything else. And farm reports, too. We had farm reports.
Okay. One of the early programs that you helped produce was called You Are the Jury, and we actually have a clip from that show. This is from 1957, the year that WKAR won a Peabody Award for this show. You were working at KAR then. You were not yet on this show. Let's listen to You Are the Jury.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to You Are the Jury, and another case from the files of the Michigan State University Highway Traffic Safety Center. Today, the case of the unexpected car.
Sure, I was out in the left lane passing, but when I started, there wasn't an approaching car in sight. I did everything I could to avoid an accident.
That was Cal Somerville, one of the drivers involved. We'll hear more of his account later. I'm Rob Downey, and my job is to bring out the facts in the case of the unexpected car.
Eventually, Dick Estelle, you took over production of that show. Tell us about that.
Well, Rob Downey did a very good job in the beginning, and of course at the time we had no idea it was going to become such a popular and award-winning program. When Rob decided that he no longer wanted to be the master of ceremonies, so to speak, then the manager of the station, Bob Coleman, decided that I would fill in for him, and I did. And we traveled all over the state of Michigan to interview people for this program, and as you said, it became a national award winner, and we were very proud of that. It's one of the very few that public radio stations had received in those years.
Moving ahead to 1967, Congress in that year passed the Public Broadcasting Act, which helped create NPR and PBS. you were playing a role in forming the public broadcasting system in those years, and it must have been a lot of uncharted territory. Tell us about that.
So uncharted that we didn't know how we were going to provide program services to all of the public radio stations in the United States.
How many were there?
96.
Okay.
At that time. Now it's well over 200 or 300. I'm not sure. But that was the big problem. If we have a central area where we can produce these programs, say Washington, D.C., or from the many individual stations who provided that service to National Public Radio, how are we going to get it out to the stations? There was no such thing as a satellite in those days. And so we had tapes that would be... It sounds funny just using the word tape.
Tape, right.
Provided the tapes to the different stations and the stations then to National Public Radio, which was just educational radio in those days. And that was the big problem, was the distribution of program services, and was a problem until, really, the satellite came forth and we were able to provide services anywhere throughout the world.
What's it like hearing those early days in your head, in your memory, with what people associate with NPR and PBS today?
Well, it's a world of difference, of course. Our world keeps moving on, and it seems that every day we are confronted with news that is good and bad. Lately, it's been bad. But we really didn't have that opportunity before. So the situation that we find ourselves in now is that some people, many people, say, why do we hear such bad news all the time? There are so many sources available to broadcast facilities that it's amazing that there aren't more reports. We're hearing reports about people being killed or in accidents or shot that never would have made the news back in those days, simply because there was no radio or television station that would pick that up and provide that news service to their communities. So really, the news itself was a very integral part of National Public Radio, and that the fact that we could get the news from so many sources provided us then with a capability of doing something that had never been done before in all of these local communities throughout the nation.
Mm-hmm. You also did TV work here at WKAR. You hosted a program in the early 80s called Estelle at Large. We've got a clip.
Estelle at Large, exploring the issues of the day with citizens and leaders of the Mid-Michigan community.
So, Dick, Estelle, tell us about Estelle at Large.
Great theme song. Well, Estelle at Large really was the same kind of program that you have here. We interviewed people we thought were important people, and however, it was on television and not radio, so it was a little different setup.
Had you done TV before?
No, I'd never done TV, other than a booth announcer, but I'd hardly subscribed to the fact that I was different from many of the programs that we had. This was different. And it was fun because it enabled us to get out into the community and interview people in the community and got them on TV. And, of course, they loved that opportunity. So it was a different show for us here at WKAR Television, and one that I love to do. I think the one that was most interesting and most popular was an interview with a woman who was in Jackson Prison. And, of course, we shaded out her face when we were broadcasting. But just to ask her about not how she got there, but how she was able to handle day by day by day, which was so different from her normal activity as a housewife.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said, that was one of the most popular that we had on that program. But we interviewed so many local people, so many people here on campus. And as I said, it was just like your program here, except it was on television.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, I was the master of ceremonies.
And now you were juggling that with the Radio Reader at
yes.
the time, if I have my chronology right. And the Radio Reader began in 64. Many people across the country know you as the Radio Reader. Just give us a synopsis of what the Radio Reader has meant to you and the place it has in your career.
Well, the Radio Reader has meant to me, has given me an opportunity to read books, and I've taken advantage of that opportunity, and that's what the program is all about. The program actually started back in the very early 30s, and the manager of the station, Bob Coleman, at that time started the program. It was the Reading Circle, I believe, and was 15 minutes long.
Okay.
But the same thing. He would read from a book. And then it expanded to a half hour. And when Bob Coleman retired, then Larry Freimeyer, who became manager, was the next Radio Reader. So actually, I inherited the program from the two previous managers of the station.
Whoever was manager was the Radio Reader.
That was it.
Okay.
And it hasn't changed since then. But the situation was that as manager, I became the Radio Reader. And in the beginning, it was a program only for WKAR. As time went on, some other stations heard the program and asked if they could receive it. So again, we went back to the tapes, and we would send tapes, bicycle tapes, they were called, because we'd send a tape to Station X, and when they played it, then they'd send it on to Station Y and so forth. And little by little, it became a national program.
Hmm.
Then with the satellite coming in, it offered us so much more opportunity.
How proud were you of the fact that you were national?
Well, very proud.
Yeah,
I was one of the originators of National Public Radio. As I said, it was called just educational radio in
yeah.
the beginning, and then National Public Radio. And I served as the chairman of the board of directors for a while. And I was, as I said, was very proud of that, and still am today, because National Public Radio has become a major source of national and international news around the nation.
Mm-hmm. Dick Estell, the Radio Reader, celebrates 50 years as the Radio Reader in 2014. He's been our guest this morning on Current State. Thanks, Dick.
You bet.
Continued success.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The sounds of Bob Baldori live in the Current State studio here today at 90.5 WKAR. You may well know Bob's career has led him to countless gigs with the likes of Chuck Berry, John Lee Hooker, Muddy Waters, and others, and he's thrived as an artist in his own right. In recent years, Boogie Bob spent a lot of time playing boogie-woogie piano around the world with Bob Seeley. Their time together has been documented in the movie Boogie Stomp, which the East Lansing Film Society is screening this month at Studio C Theaters in Okemos. And on Saturday, Bob will attend a special screening of Boogie Stomp at Studio C to answer questions and to meet fans. And he's been busy playing the music that you've been hearing today on Current State. It's great to have you in the studio, Bob. Thanks for coming in.
It's great to be here working.
Yeah. How did the concept of a movie get started, and what's the process of promoting a movie been like?
It's been a lot of fun. I'm just at the front end of starting to promote it, and so far that's been fun. I just got back from the Sonoma Film Festival in Sonoma, California last week, and it was, you know, they treated us like royalty and screened the film a couple times, and turns out people in California like it as much as people in Michigan, so I'm looking forward to sort of a year of film festivals and promotions like that. I got started on it 4 or 5 years ago, partly because a producer asked me to do a treatment for a show that was going to be a template, and this was the first of what was going to be several shows. And the idea behind it was sort of under the radar, finding master musicians like Bob Seeley, who weren't popular and people didn't know about, but who had still in the inner circles were recognized as master players. And I was going to start with Hubert Sumlin, who I was representing at the time, another genius of a guitar player.
We just lost him, right? I mean, didn't
he just passed away?
Just died,
unfortunately, yeah. But his manager retained me to help him do the contractual work for an album that he had recorded with Keith Richards and Eric Clapton, and I stepped in and helped him clear up all the contracts. We got to be friends, but then I ran into Seeley, so I started the first one with him, and it's been an absolute pleasure working with him.
How long have you been playing with Bob Seeley?
About 5 years.
Okay, and how did you two meet?
Well, I was invited into a boogie-woogie festival in Detroit in honor of Johnny Johnson, who also played with Chuck Berry. And the promoter knew that I had worked with Chuck as much as Johnny, and he invited me and all these other great piano players in there, and they were all playing, and then this guy gets up and knocks everybody out of the room, and I'm asking everyone, who is this guy? And they tell me it's Bob Seeley, and I say, where is he from? And they say, Detroit. And I grew up in Detroit, and I never heard of the guy, and he just killed me, and we got to be buddies. He invited me out to his gig at Charlie's Crab, where he'd played for 32 years in the back of the Fish Joint.
Wow.
And all of that is in the movie. And
What defines boogie-woogie to you? Describe it.
Boogie-woogie is, Seeley describes it as happy blues. It's basically up-tempo rhythm and improvisation over a blues form. And the main characteristic of it is the various patterns in the left hand that are easily recognizable. I just played 3 or 4 of them out of, you know, there's an infinite variety, but they're 8 to the bar, swinging, rhythmic left hand. Rodney Whittaker in the movie says, if it doesn't make you want to get up and shake your behind and dance, then the musicians aren't doing their job.
You've performed with a lot of other really well-known players over the years, none more famous than Chuck Berry. What's it like to be on stage with Chuck Berry? He's 86 now, by the way.
Thanks. I know. But he's still doing the duck walk, though.
Is that right?
Yep.
Good for him.
He's in great shape, and I still work with him occasionally. In fact, I'm playing in St. Louis in July. We're doing Arthur Migliazza, a younger player who's as good as Seeley, and I have also been doing shows together when Bob isn't available, and we have a Performing Arts Center gig in St. Louis in July, and I think Chuck's going to be there for that one. Then I'm going to play with him at Blueberry Hill, where he plays once a month. in St. Louis.
And you juggle all this musical activity with a career as an attorney locally as well.
Yeah, I got the day job.
How do you juggle all this? I don't know. Do you like getting 4 hours of sleep a night or what?
Yeah, well, I'm trying to move into the music and piano playing thing full time, but I've got two kids that are going to college. So.
Oh, say no more.
Yeah.
A lot of people listening are aware of your distant past in the Woolies. Why don't we give a listen to the Woolies right now on WKAR? Okay. Well, I walk 47 miles of barbed wire, use a cobra snake for a necktie, got a brand new house on the roadside, I said it's made out of rattlesnake hide, brand new chimney baby built on top, I said it's made out of human skulls, come on take a little walk on the aisle and yeah, tell me who do you love, who do you love? The Woolies, with our guest Bob Bell. Dory, do you dust off any of the Woolies tracks when you perform?
Okay. Yeah, in fact, the guys in the group, we get together several times a year, and I've been playing with the rhythm section or part of it at the Avenue Cafe occasionally. We'll probably play one or two gigs there this summer just because I like playing around here when I have a break in the schedule. But yeah, I still work with Stormy Rice, who's singing on that cut, and my brother Jeff, who's playing on that, and B. Mitros, who I refer to as one of the top four or five drummers in the greater Okemos-Williamston area.
South Central Meridian Township. He's a legend, right?
He is, but he's a terrific drummer, and he's an attorney, too.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. What do you make of that? Well, the music world is being overrun by attorneys.
The
legal world is being overrun by musicians. I don't know.
The job market's so tough, you can't even get into a pickup rock and roll band without an advanced degree.
Do you ever wish you'd become a bigger star yourself, more famous individually, or do you like the level of relative anonymity that you have?
Well, I like playing with a group a lot, and of course it would be a little bit more comfortable if we were in the, and we're still trying, Celia and I and Arthur and I are trying to move up into a circuit that would allow me to practice less law and do more playing. It's a sort of a performing arts circuit that we're right on the edge of. That would be a lot of fun for me.
What do you think when you see musicians performing into their 70s or 80s? Or the Stones are going out and they're going out on tour for the 50th anniversary year. The Woolies, Who Do You Love, was almost 50 years ago.
That's right.
I mean,
well, you know, like you just said, Chuck is 86, so, and people always say, when are you going to retire or quit? And I tell him, I don't even have to think about it till he does. He's got about 20 years on me.
Holy cow. Yeah, it keeps you young. I mean, we've heard that 100 times over the years. Right?
It does. There's no, well, my partner, Bob Seeley, I mean, you can't keep up with him, and he's 83 or 84 now. And if I don't play 2 or 3 hours a day, I can't even get on stage with a guy.
How about that? Well, you've been good enough to play between segments of today's show here for us. Would you play an entire song here for us to take us out of the show?
Well, sure.
You can hardly refuse now,
yeah,
Bob.
Well, I'm just going to play until you guys get tired of it.
Okay.
I'll play a little Chuck Berry backbeat for you until we get out of here.
We want to thank Bob Bell Dory, whose movie, Boogie Stomp.
Oh, yeah. Let's talk about that.
We mentioned it going in, but it's part of the East Lansing Film Society screening at Studio C Theaters, and you'll be out to see everybody to answer their questions this Saturday.
Saturday at 6:15.
Okay.
I'll be there.
All right, take us out, Bob. That's Boogie Bob Bell Dory, who's been our special guest here today on Current State. Hope you've enjoyed it. We'll be back tomorrow. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.
I said bye. bye-bye. I said bye-bye, Johnny. Goodbye, Johnny, be good. She remembered taking money earned from gathering crops.